was destined, I suppose, for an academic or administrative career of some kind. During all these years, I had received virtually no scientific education, apart from a maternal great-grandfather who had been a village doctor in rural Prussia in the early decades of the last century. There was nothing medical or scientific in my family background. My father was an eminent English human rights lawyer and academic, and my mother, a German refugee from Nazi Germany, who would probably have been a philologist if she hadn't refused to join the women's branch of the Hitler Youth, the League of German Maidens, and hence had been denied entry into university. Apart from the one doctor in Prussia, my ancestors on both sides of my family were teachers and clergymen and tradesmen. Although my uncle had been a Messerschmitt fighter pilot in a crack squadron until shot down in 1940. While at Oxford, I fell in love, love which was unrequited, and driven by self-pitying despair, I had, to my father's deep dismay, abandoned university and run away to work as a hospital porter in a mining town in the north of England, trying to emulate Jack Nicholson heading off for Alaska at the end of the movie Five Easy Pieces. I spent 6 months there, spending the days lifting patients on and off operating tables, cleaning walls and equipment, and assisting the anaesthetists. I lived in a small room in a semi-derelict old fever hospital with a corrugated iron roof on the muddy banks of the polluted River Wansbeck. It was a few miles away from the coast where the beaches were black with sea coal. There was a huge coal-fired power station which I could see in the distance from my room, with high chimneys pouring white smoke and steam into the wind off the sea. At night, the rising steam was lit by the arc lamps that stood over the mountains of coal beside the turbine halls, over which I could see bulldozers crawling beneath the stars. I wrote second-rate, self-obsessed poetry, in which I described this view as being of both heaven and hell. Full of youthful melodrama, I saw myself as living in a world as red as blood and as white as snow, although the surgery I saw was not especially bloody and the winter was mild, without any snow. I was profoundly lonely. In retrospect, I was obviously trying to realize my own unhappiness by working in a hospital, in a place of illness and suffering, and perhaps I was curing myself of my adolescent angst and unrequited love in the process. It was also a ritual rebellion against my poor, well-meaning father, who up till then had largely determined the course of my life. After 6 months of this, I desperately wanted to come home, both to my family, but also to a professional middle-class career, although one of my own choosing. Having spent 6 months watching surgeons operating, I decided that this was what I should do. I found its controlled and altruistic violence deeply appealing. It seemed to involve excitement and job security, a combination of manual and mental skills, and power and social status as well. Nevertheless, it was not until 8 years later, when as a junior doctor I saw that first aneurysm operation, that I discovered my vocation. I was fortunate that my college at Oxford allowed me to come back after my year away to complete my degree, and I was later accepted to study medicine at the only medical school in London which took students without any scientific qualifications. Having been rejected by all the other London medical schools, since I had neither O-levels nor A-levels in science, I had telephoned the Royal Free Medical School. They asked me to come for an interview next day. The interview was with an elderly, pipe-smoking Scot, the medical school registrar, in a small and cramped office. He was to retire a few weeks later, and perhaps he let me into the medical school as a kind of joke or celebration, or perhaps his mind was elsewhere. He asked me if I enjoyed fly-fishing. I replied that I did not. He said that it was best to see medicine as a form of craft, neither art nor science, an opinion with which I came to agree in later years. The interview took 5 minutes, and he offered me a place in the medical school starting 3 weeks later. Selection for medical schools has become a rather more rigorous process since then. I believe the medical school at the huge London hospital where I now work uses role-playing with actors, along with many other procedures, to select the doctors of the future. The nervous candidates must show their ability to break bad news by telling an actor that their cat has just been run over by a car. Failure to take the scenario seriously, I am told, results in immediate rejection. Whether this is any better than the process I went through remains, I believe, unproven. Apparently, the actors help select the successful candidates. I joined what was called a first MB course, which was a year's crash course in basic science, and which led on to the second MB course, which was the standard 5-year course of undergraduate medical training. This was the last year that the medical school ran a first MB course, and the department was something of a scientific and academic backwater, with the course taught by a number of eccentric and often embittered scientists, although many of them were at the very beginning of their careers and rapidly moved on elsewhere. One became a famous science writer. Another eventually became a peer and chairman of the Tory party. The others were older teachers approaching retirement, some of whom did not bother to hide their dislike of the slightly odd mix of first MB students. A stockbroker, a Saudi princess, a Ford truck salesman, mixed up with other younger students who had poor A-level results, and one, it turned out, who had forged them. Our days were spent gradually dissecting and disassembling large white rabbits for biology, titrating chemicals for chemistry, and failing to understand the physics lectures. Some of the lecturers were inspiring, some risible. The atmosphere was anxious, verging on hysterical. We were all desperate to become doctors, and most of us felt a failure for some reason or another, although, as far as I can remember, we all passed the final examination. I then spent 2 years of preclinical studies in the medical school, anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, and pharmacology, followed by 3 years as a clinical student in the hospital. The anatomy involved the students being divided up into small groups, and each group was given an embalmed cadaver, which we slowly took apart over the course of the year. Not especially attractive to begin with, the cadavers were a sorry sight by the year's end. The bodies were kept in the long room, a large and high attic space with skylights, with half a dozen trolleys on either side, with sinister shapes covered by green tarpaulins. The place smelled strongly of formaldehyde. On the first day of the course, holding our newly purchased dissection manuals with a few instruments in a small canvas roll, we queued up a little nervously on the stairs leading to the long room. The doors were opened with a flourish by the long-room attendant, and we went in to be presented to our respective intact corpses. It was a traditional part of medical education, going back hundreds of years, but has now been largely abandoned. As a surgeon, one has to learn real anatomy all over again. The anatomy of a living, bleeding body is quite different from the greasy, grey flesh of cadavers embalmed for dissection. The anatomy we learned from dissection was perhaps of limited value, but it was an important initiation rite, marking our transition from the lay world to the world of disease and death, and perhaps inuring us to it. It was also quite a sociable process, as one sat with a group of fellow students around one's cadaver, picking and scratching away at dead tissue, learning the hundreds of names that had to be learnt, of the veins and arteries and bones and organ parts and their relations. I remember being particularly fascinated by the anatomy of the hand. There was a plateau.